The gospel is found in the Apostle Paul's first letter to the church at Corinth. St. Paul writes, "If I speak in the tongues of mortals and of angels, but do not have love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but do not have love, I am nothing. If I give away all my possessions, and if I hand over my body so that I may boast, but do not have love, I gain nothing. Love is patient. Love is kind. Love is not envious or boastful or arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice in wrongdoing, but rejoices in the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. But as for prophecies, they will come to an end. As for tongues, they will cease. As for knowledge, it will come to an end. For we know only in part, and we prophesy only in part. But when the complete comes, the partial will come to an end. When I was a child, I spoke like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became an adult, I put an end to childish ways. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then we will see face to face. Now I know only in part. Then I will know fully, even as I have been fully known. And now, faith, hope, and love abide, these three. And the greatest of these is love." The Gospel of Christ. When I was a child, I spoke like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child. When I was a child, I didn't know very many old people. The adults in my life were all around my parents' age. My family had immigrated to Canada, leaving any elderly relatives too far away for the kind of contact that fosters true knowing. It wasn't until I was about 15 that I began to spend time with people who, back when I was 15, I considered to be elderly. It's funny how those things change as you grow older. Mayo and Avi were the grandparents of a high school friend whose family I had become very close to. Mayo and Avi opened their large home to a gang of us teenagers, and their hospitality was rewarded by our eagerness to help them to do the things that their aging bodies no longer allowed them to do. We tended their large yard. We tilled, planted, hoed, weeded, and harvested their half-acre garden plot. We did household chores. We helped fetch groceries, and we generally kept their homestead looking as fresh as a daisy. I say daisy because one of our chores was painting their century-old wooden home a very bright yellow. You could see them, their house, from miles away. Helping Mayo and Afi was its own reward because their generosity of spirit meant that they were more than willing to share with us their hard-won wisdom, wisdom born of surviving the Depression. Mayo had been a registered nurse in her younger days, and Afi was a classically trained violin player. He managed to cobble together a kind of living out of occasional stints with various orchestras and symphonies, and he also tried his hand at directing choirs. I liked nothing better than at the end of their day, which was usually about the same time as darkness arrived, Mayo would brew some herbal tea and Afi would begin to tell stories. I learned a great deal about life in the 1930s from these two survivors. It didn't take me long to figure out that Mayo's nursing career was responsible for whatever wealth they enjoyed, and that Afi was a bit of a dreamer. The kind of dreamer who, even though his ability to hoist a bow over the strings had long since left him, he still longed to hear the phone ring with a booking. He wanted to enjoy once again the job, the profession, the calling of making music, even though his body would not allow him to. It was from Afi that I first began to learn about classical music. I had never heard anything other than popular music until I met them. My love of Handel, Mozart, Vivaldi, that was born under Afi's tutelage. The summer that Mayo and Afi celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary sticks out in my mind because, in addition to helping them plan their party, my friends and I learned a great deal about the power of love to sustain a life. Afi was approaching his 90th year while Mayo was in her late 80s, and the delight that these two lovers enjoyed in one another's company was inspiring. I remember once mustering up the courage to ask Mayo to tell us what was the secret to a lasting marriage. I can still hear her telling me not to be fooled by good looks or riches. According to Mayo, sexual attraction fades over time and riches are cold comfort. No, she said, what really counts is a good sense of humor and the ability to give a good back rub. Humor in the face of poverty is absolutely vital. Humor in a marriage is the most important thing, she said. And then she went on to embarrass us all by saying, after some time, your interest in sex is rarely piqued. But a good back rub, there's something that you never need coaxing to enjoy. A good back rub. Afi chimed in, noting that giving a good back rub could often pique his interest in moving to another room in the house. A sense of humor and the ability to give a good back rub. Now, there's wisdom for the ages. At the tender age of 15, I remember being both embarrassed and delighted by their sharing this wisdom with us. I thought that by learning the secret to a good marriage, I had been given some sort of secret knowledge about love itself. When I was a child, I spoke like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child. When I became an adult, I put an end to childish ways. In the words of Joni Mitchell, I've looked at love from both sides now, from win and lose, and still somehow it's love's illusions I recall. I really don't know love at all. The Apostle Paul, who by most accounts knew precious little about what we would call love, is responsible for passing on to generations after generations one of the greatest love poems ever written. 1 Corinthians 13 is without a doubt the most popular reading at Western weddings, as brides and grooms, whether they are Christian, pseudo-Christians, non-Christians, or simply influenced by Hallmark sentimentality, they seem to confidently select this passage to celebrate their love for one another over and over again. Most preachers, well, we have to stop ourselves from rolling our eyes when prospective brides and grooms suggest this passage. We've been taught to understand that this text has nothing to do with the kind of love that lovers need to sustain a lasting marriage. Even if you know nothing at all about the rest of Paul's letter to the church at Corinth, if you know anything at all about the love married couples share, you know that it's not anything like the love that is described in this particular text. Now, I'm as much of a romantic as the next person, but I ask you, patience, kindness, that's one. You need patience and kindness, sure. And maybe you'll get lucky and be able to avoid being envious or boastful, arrogant or rude. And good luck to you if you do. But never insisting on having your own way, never being irritable or resentful, bearing all things, believing all things, I haven't been married for very long, but give me a break. Show me a couple who don't ever engage in a battle of wills or build up resentments or succeed in bearing and believing everything about one another. Well, that couple is in all likelihood headed for some serious trouble. My darling Carol, she's perfect in every way. And I, of course, I'm perfect in every way, and we're sublimely happy. So happy that birds sing when we walk by and flowers stand tall in our saintly presence. You know that's not true. Carol, you are the love of my life, and being married to you is the best thing that has ever happened to me. But you know better than anyone in this room that I am annoying, to say the least, to live with up close and personal. I have a job that interferes with our life together on a regular basis. And when I'm on a roll, I can be arrogant and rude. I can take arrogance and rudeness to an art level. And even though I'd never say a bad word about Carol, especially not from the pulpit, I will tell you this. If Carol was never boastful, arrogant, or rude, if she was always patient and kind, never insisting on her own way, never irritable or resentful, well, I don't think I would be able to live with her. That's not the kind of love that any of us could live with, let alone be in love with. I want a real partner. Someone who will engage me in all of who they are, the good and the bad, the beautiful and the not so beautiful, for better or for worse, in sickness and in health. The Apostle Paul is not talking about the kind of love to sustain a marriage. Paul is writing to a community in Corinth that is engaged in conflict. Indeed, the followers of Jesus' teachings in the city of Corinth were locked in conflict over a whole slew of issues. They disagreed on just about everything. The last thing these folks needed was a sappy love poem dedicated to emotion. What the Apostle Paul gives them is a piece of the Jewish wisdom tradition mixed with a dash of ancient Greek wisdom about agape. We translate the word agape simply as love. But our word love is not sufficient in and of itself to carry the full meaning of the Greek word agape. Neither is the word agape capable of carrying the full meaning of the English word love. In Greek, the English word love can be translated as eros, which has to do with the romance and the passion between lovers. The word love can also be translated as philia, which refers to the affection between friends or the ethics that foster harmony between people. Philia is considered necessary to foster peace among people. Love can also be translated as storge, which refers to the affection, especially the kind of affection parents and children share, or to empathy for the strong for the weak, or the healthy for the sick, or even the love of one's enemy. Affection, kindness is based in another's need. And this kind of affection and kindness the Greeks would call storge. So there you have three different kinds of love before you even get to the kind of love that the Apostle Paul is talking about. Agape is a kind of unconditional love, the kind of love that is not concerned with the lover's needs or the wants or the status, but only concerned with the absolute needs of the other. I once heard agape defined as the kind of love that seeks the best for the other without regard to one's own standing in the relationship. In other words, agape is a love that expects nothing in return. Agape is a love that is beyond emotion. Agape is beyond emotion because it has become compassion or empathy. Agape is the kind of love that we only catch glimmers of in this life. Agape must be embodied in order to be. Agape is embodied compassion, embodied empathy, embodied love. Agape is beyond description, impossible to fully define, and yet we would all recognize agape when we experience it. Agape is a dream embodied and enacted. Agape is the love that we call God. Agape is the love that we call God embodied and enacted in the world. Agape encompasses eros, philia, and storge, and all the emotions that go along with these loves, and is more than the sum of these parts. Agape is beyond the beyond, for agape is God. God is love. The best translation that I've ever come across of this particular wisdom poem from the Apostle Paul goes like this. God is patient. God is kind. God is not jealous. God does not brag. God is not arrogant. God does not take into account a wrong suffered. God does not rejoice in unrighteousness. God rejoices with truth. God bears all things. God hopes all things. God endures all things. God never fails. When I was a child, I spoke like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became an adult, I put an end to childish ways. When I was a child, I thought that love was something I needed to learn or to find or to do. As I become more fully human, and I have a long way to go, I'm just beginning to put an end to childish ways. Pierre Teilhard de Chardin wrote that love is the very physical structure of the universe. The core belief of all the great world religions is that the underlying reality of all that is love. Teilhard writes, love is the very physical structure of the universe. Everything is desiring union with everything in one sense or another. Teilhard says, I actually believe that what it means to know and trust God is to trust that love is the source, the heart, the engine, and the goal of life. Our primal and deepest act of faith is the willingness to somehow say, it's okay. Because at its core, all of reality is good and of God, of love. Teilhard believed that at the very heart of the core of all reality was God, who is love. The source of all that is, the core of everything, is love. When Michael Morwood was here, he taught us that after 13.8 billion years of evolution, the divine is at work in the universe, coming into expression in us. If we are created in the image of God, then love is what we are made of. Love is who we are. Is it any wonder then that love becomes known when we see ourselves in the other? The embodiment of love is achieved when we who are made of love recognize ourselves in the other, because love is not something that we do, love is something that we are. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. Now we see in a mirror dimly, but then we will see face to face. When we recognize ourselves in the other, we are for a moment the embodiment of love. Now we know only in part, then we will know fully, even as we have been fully known. When we recognize ourselves in the other, faith, hope, hope, and love abide. These three, and the greatest of these is love.